Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Army Benevolent Fund. My guest for the April edition of General Talk is Lieutenant General Tom Coppinger Sims, Deputy Commander, Strategic Command, who, after commanding 5th Battalion of the Rifles, made a career decision to focus on the new dimension of the battlefield, cyber. Colonel Commandant of the Rifles, we talk new technologies, we talk old practices, and the application of the two in the armed forces today. I hope you enjoy the programme.
Tom, it's great to be here. You are really, effectively, the cyber king of the Ministry of Defence. Is that fair to say? In your role as Deputy Commander, UK Strategic Command, can you run through the data and information threat that we currently face in the UK?
Well, as an obedient servant, I'd point out my boss is probably the king of cyber, and that makes me a prince or a princess one way or another. But I think people will be well aware of the degree to which their data is precious to both other nation states and to criminals. And everybody will be well aware how many phishing emails they get on their personal devices every day, and the sort of texts they get from somebody telling them they've delivered a parcel and inviting them to click on the link to see where that parcel is. So I think people's sort of awareness of attacks coming through their personal devices, through their email, their texts, is pretty obvious. What isn't always obvious is how that threat plays out behind that click. But I think the bits that are less obvious to people is the amount of sort of state threat that we're under. So the amount of people trying to attack, get into our systems in defence. And we have about 6 million incidents a day on our boundary protection every single day in defence. Now, those aren't all attacks, but those are people bumping up against our protection and trying to get beyond it. So that's a very, very high level of activity. And you know, all the usual players are guilty. Some of them are more skilled at obfuscating their activity than others, but most of it's pretty visible. And then I think in a year where about half the world is going to elections, the other bit that is spoken about, but I think people are less aware of, is using cyberspace to try and affect our perceptions, try and affect our, you know, what we believe, and then how we behave, particularly in the voting booth, which is not my problem at Strategic Command, but also how our soldiers, sailors and aviators behave when they're on operations, for instance, which is clearly part of our job. So that's how I sort of think about the threat to ourselves as individuals, the threat to sort of government departments and what we do to protect the nation, help it prosper, and then the threat to people's brains and sort of hearts and minds and how they behave in the voting booth or as citizens or as soldiers.
Your career has been pretty innovative in that sense, because up until you commanded 5th Battalion of the Rifles, but thereafter you've gone straight into information and data, from commanding 1st Intelligence, Surveillance and Reconnaissance Brigade to then going on to 4th Command. How do you put into words really what the shape of our information and intel defences are today?
Well, it's a complex ecosystem, and it is an ecosystem, so it's not a sort of command and control thing that many of your listeners would recognise, because of course we work very closely with other bits of government, and you'll know there's a thing called the National Cybersecurity Centre, which is part of GCHQ but has sort of elements of defence and other government departments in it, and we sort of run that nationally. That's about reaching out with industry, for instance, not just private individuals. And then clearly there's a big sort of defence element to that. And did I mention GCHQ, you know, who clearly play a big role in that? And we have a partnership with them called the National Cyber Force, which is how we project power through cyberspace. That could be about international adversaries, or it could be about serious and organised crime, or protecting children online, or whatever else. So there's inevitably a defensive and an offensive element to this. And, you know, that's done in very close partnership with other bits of government. And of course, it's then done in very close partnership with our friends across the world, you know, not just America, but a whole range of allies and partners across the world. So that's broadly the size and shape. I mean, what I was going to go back to is actually why I made that change from a sort of very conventional sort of infantry career
I rather assume that that change would be made for you, but you decided, you took that decision yourself.
Well, it was a bit of opportunity and forcing. No, I mean, I felt very strongly, having had two very stimulating but very tough tours in Iraq and then Afghanistan, that we were amazingly good at winning battles, but we were not always winning the wars we needed to. And that I think the role of information in helping us win wars as well as battles was pretty foundational in an information age. And I think you can see that playing out, you know, day by day, both, you know, our own successes, our adversary successes, our friends like Ukraine, you know, the successes and challenges they've had in the information space. But I think, you know, turning winning battles into winning wars is fundamentally about information.
Let's talk about Ukraine. What are the challenges they face in the information space?
So again, I spoke about the sort of cyber threats earlier. You'll probably be well aware that from 2013-14 onwards, so the first move on Crimea, the Russians have subjected Ukraine to a sort of a significant bombardment in cyberspace. There is a bit of a trope out there that the reinstigated invasion a couple of years ago, that cyber was the dog that didn't bark. That is a trope. That's nonsense. It might not have been able to bite, but it was certainly barking. And the reason the Russians didn't have quite such success they expected was because the Ukrainians have built up a huge amount of resilience and cybersecurity over the past 10 years, with a bit of help from their friends, but really with a really innovative and well-educated workforce in Ukraine. So very, very significant levels of attack accompanying the illegal and barbaric invasion. And I mean, you'll probably have heard about the Viasat attack, so the system of satellites that not only helped Ukraine's command and control, but also runs Germany's agriculture and a lot of its alternative energy system. And that went down for quite a significant amount of time as sort of collateral damage, if you like, when Ukraine was attacked. And it's now a matter of public record that, you know, in the first few days of the invasion, Ukraine very quickly managed to secure its own government data and move that data into secure infrastructure outside its own borders, so that even if Russia had got to Kyiv, it could maintain continuity of government. And if you like, I suppose that's the 21st century equivalent of you know, President de Gaulle leaving Paris with state papers and gold and moving to London so that he could maintain continuity of government of France. And that's the sort of, yeah, I suppose that's the 21st century equivalent of how you keep things going when your country's under very significant existential threat. So I think that'll give you some idea of the initial challenge with the invasion. And then today, it's of course still very significant cyber threat. But we define cyberspace as not just the sort of man-made built, the internet, if you like, but the electromagnetic spectrum as well. And what you're seeing on the front lines in Ukraine at the moment is a very, very, very intense competition in cyberspace and the electromagnetic spectrum to get whatever it is, your drones, your uncrewed systems, across the front lines to be able to do damage to the other side. And whether they can do that or not depends very largely about whether you can control the spectrum.
That places a demand on our soldiers intellectually, way above what used to be the case, say, 30, 40 years ago. So therefore, to recruit and to man these systems requires thinking outside the box. How do we necessarily need to recruit someone to do 5 weeks of square bashing and then another 10 weeks out on the soldier plane digging holes? You need some form of different type of soldier for that. How have we amended our recruitment to face that threat?
Well, first thing I'd say is not enough. We've got a big gap in the sort of digital and cyber skills that we need across the whole workforce. That's not just about specialists. It's not just about the sort of ninjas that we recruit. It's about every rifleman and guardsman, frankly, because the nature of soldiering remains the same, that war is brutal and visceral and, you know, ultimately, as you're seeing in Ukraine, can end up hand-to-hand and face-to-face. But also, the character has changed fundamentally, and the way we use our machines to help us fight is fundamentally different. So every rifleman now needs to have an awareness of what's going on in cyberspace. And frankly, that's not a surprise because their day-to-day lives have changed immeasurably. You know, You and I remember a day when we used to go to a bank and cash a cheque. You say that to a young rifleman or guardsman these days and they wouldn't have a clue what you're talking about because it's all done on their mobile phone at the speed of, you know, the digital age. So their day-to-day lives have changed hugely. Their access to information has just changed beyond all recognition from, you know, when you and I joined the army. And their professional skills need to move as quickly. They aren't, but we're trying to speed it up across defence.
One of the problems you've got is that the bring it back down to the everyday is the mobile phone is such a part of everyday lives. All operations, how do you aim to control that? I mean, to stop people communicating with their loved ones at home, doing their banking, doing their everyday stuff, which were otherwise done by blueies in the old days. How do you try and control that in the modern day?
Well, I guess in many ways the same way as we controlled blueies in the old days. I mean, people talk now about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which I'm sure you used to teach people about as an adjunct at Sandhurst. And I think Wi-Fi comes in somewhere in that hierarchy of needs these days, the ability to get online and communicate with their friends and families. So I think partially that's, you know, as old as history. You know, we've always put some constraints around communication when people afford, because you've got to protect their mates and make sure that the information that they're revealing is not, you know, going to damage somebody's lives. So clearly, some things have changed, but some things remain the same.
As commander of the Force Troops, now the 6th UK Division, is it now one of the largest commands in the British Army. How did you find commanding such a disparate organisation, which doesn't have the presence on the ground as say an armoured division, but does have such a huge clout? And that's quite an accolade to have to your name.
It was you know, a great privilege. I mean, the fun thing about it was that you were at one and the same time provided support to 3rd UK Division and 1st UK Division, but also conducting a whole bunch of operations in our own right, including across defence. So it was our plug-in, if you like, to the wider defence world, which is sort of where I spent a lot of my time. So, and you were busy every single day of the week. So whereas the more conventional formations would sort of deploy, recover from an operation or an exercise, we have people there, including in cyberspace, who are fighting every day of their lives with adversaries where we never lose contact. So it was pretty much a full-on experience. It certainly exercised a bunch of leadership skills that I hadn't really developed till then, you know, because you're dealing with quite different audiences, quite a different workforce, quite a different mix of skills. I'll be careful what I say here, but, you know, the degree to which your soldiers are cleverer than you is even greater in that sort of atmosphere. So you're dealing with specialists who are far more expert in the area than you always were. And that requires a different approach to leadership, a different level of humility, I think, and a different awareness of what rank and power means. Because there's a lot more information, a lot more knowledge, a lot more skill lower down the hierarchy, and you need to lead consciously.
In our multicultural society of today, there's no guarantee that people who you have recruited who are working for you, be they soldiers or civilians in the military sphere, there's no guarantee that they're necessarily on side. And actually, as we've seen recently with that young signaller who got caught for terror charges, how do you try and guarantee that the people you've got are going to remain loyal?
I think that's as old as history. I mean, connecting people to the purpose, what we do, you know, we're here to protect the nation and help it prosper. The army has its own definition of purpose. I think connecting people to that purpose, making sure they feel part of a team, welcomed in a team, make sure they feel important in a team, is your greatest antidote to people recruiting them to work for the other side. I think that's as old as history.
Creating a team today, when people presumably in the cybersphere are working remotely or from home, that must be harder. That must place challenges on your leadership that you wouldn't otherwise have had if you were, say, in the field.
Well, I think some of these things are slightly overstated, actually. I mean, every operation I've been on, every operation you went on, you worked remotely. And I don't know, your first tour in Northern Ireland, I'm willing to bet that you ended up commanding platoon where you very rarely saw your company commander. And you got quite used to, you know, working remotely. Certainly I did. My first tour in Northern Ireland, I very rarely saw anybody. It was a half platoon in a thing that looked like a submarine on the border. And I was very, very used to working very remotely. So I think, you know, sometimes we overstate these things.
Yeah.
In Afghanistan, I would get around and see my companies as frequently as possible, but that was sometimes, you know, once a week, sometimes once every 2 weeks. So I think some of these things are overstated because we don't really understand how we fight. I mean, the whole of history is dispersal, because if you, when you come together for an O group or in an FUP, you're vulnerable because one artillery shell can wipe you all out. So I just think some of these contrasts are overblown. So in learning how to lead across vast distances or complex areas, you know, you lean back on the skills you developed for the first 20, 25 years of your career, because that's the essence of what we do.
Within all this, one of the great cries, of course, is about AI. Can you tell us about AI and the armed forces and how we need to harness AI?
Yeah, so it's, I mean, AI is a pretty loaded couple of letters. Artificial intelligence means an awful lot of things to an awful lot of people. I tend to, as a simple instrument, I tend to sort of bring it back down to basics. It's really about using what we now call data, information, if you like, words, numbers. It's how we use that to help us fight better, and also run defense better, run the army better. But it's really about fighting and operating better and delivering, you know, our purpose to protect the nation and help it prosper. So I think of sort of data-driven capabilities in three different ways, and just, you know, I'm going to geek up a bit, so forgive me. And there are three A's, because as a simple soldier, you always try and stick to three.
Don't mind, I'm a guardsman, Harris, just keep it straightforward.
even a Harrogian guardsman will understand this. You know, you can do three things with data. You can analyse it, and that allows you to make better decisions, what I call precision. You can automate stuff with it in a way that happens in your banking app that we were speaking about earlier, every second. And automation gives you speed. Just stuff moves very quick because you've got machines doing stuff that humans used to take a long time to do. And then the last thing you can do with data is create autonomy. So these drones that command themselves once launched are using different levels of artificial intelligence to give themselves orders and to be able to adjust, you know, their flight pattern or recognize where they are in the world or whatever. So, and that gives you mass, because of course, once you've got those drones, you can link them together and that can deliver mass in a particular way. So analysis, automation, autonomy, delivering precision, speed, and mass. And you don't have to be a guardsman to understand what those three capabilities, what those three things can do for you when you're operating and fighting. So I think AI has huge promise and you're seeing it every day in Ukraine, to one degree or another, those three things being used. And for a relatively small island nation with a pretty fixed population, you know, who are always thinking about how you recreate mass, because mass still matters, autonomy in particular, is going to be really important to us in the future. So that's the sort of, you know, what it means to the armed forces and delivering, you know, our purpose. And then, like any large organization, you know, that's given 50 odd billion quid a year by the taxpayer, you can also use those sort of data-driven capabilities to make your the organization, defense, the army, the navy, the air force, much more efficient, much more productive, and frankly stop people doing some really boring stuff and get them to do much more exciting stuff, where the brain, which is still the best artificial intelligence there is, where the brain is maximised and they're not just shuffling papers around. We can get machines doing that.
Yeah, there's a great cry you talk about mass, but how does mass fit into the Army Equipment Under Programme, which is not due to deliver another 10 years?
Well, I mean, that's a good question to ask the DCGS or the CGS, because I'm not an expert in the Army Equipment Programme.
Of course, within all that, it requires us to be integrated well with our allies and so on. And then we talk about platforms for AI, things like presumably our aircraft carriers in due course will not need to have manned aircraft on board because they can have drones flying off them instead. Is that something we're looking at now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think anything that we do that's dull or dirty or dangerous, you know, if we can put a machine there, we probably should, provided that, you know, ethically that's the right sort of thing to get a machine doing. So the degree to which future aircraft or indeed maritime craft are crewed, or I think there's a phrase now, optionally crewed, where you can have something that can be manned or not, is pretty prevalent. We've had that, funnily enough, in our engineering capabilities. So, you know, a couple of our big armored engineer platforms have had remote control built into them from the start. So not just the sort of wheelbarrows you remember from Northern Ireland, but our Terriers and Trojans, I think, can be operated remotely. Because when you're dealing with mines in a large minefield, taking the crew person out can be a very advantageous thing to do. So this is not that new.
Good for morale too, I imagine.
Very good for morale.
My limited experience there.
Very good for morale, yeah.
Come back to control though of these machines. Presumably, if it is possible to hack into someone's national cyber infrastructure, presumably also be possible to take control of these machines. I'm thinking back to Waterloo, where missiles, I think, were first used, and there was a time when they often, in fact, indeed, actually, with Milan, they also sometimes used to cut and run, turn on the operator. What happens if AI were to be, say, suddenly a state actor got hold of the control of them, and then suddenly they became, our AI were used against us?
So, I think the competition, as I mentioned, in Ukraine playing out in the electromagnetic spectrum is broadly what you're talking about. That's what you're doing. You're trying to cut the link between the operator and the machine, and in the example you're suggesting, you know, turn it around and operate it against the person it's supposed to be working with. I mean, that is technically possible. It's VV hard to do. So I don't think we need to worry about that too much. But the real challenge at the moment is that it just can't do the job it's set to do, and it crashes to the earth. So that's the game we're in, and that's the competition that plays out. And did I mention, I think you mentioned, we need a lot more skilled people to be able to play that game, whether they're generalists, you know, guardsmen and riflemen, or specialists in the cyber world or indeed space or wherever else.
If you are a specialist, yet you're not inclined to want to join, so you'd call it the regular Green Army, the chap that marches around in drill square bashing his feet left, right and centre. How would you go about applying to join to this rather peculiar element of the military defence, we call it?
Well, so there's a range of choices. You can come in uniform or you can come not in uniform. And so we've got a whole range of jobs for civil servants. You know, we talk about the whole force, civil servants, you know, soldiers, sailors, aviators, and of course contractors. You know, there are a huge amount of people in cyberspace who work in industry. And, you know, again, one of the great lessons we're getting from Ukraine is how we need to be much better integrated with industry. And if you work in space or in cyber, you know, that's quite different. You don't sort of, you know, as with the army, you get handed a tank by industry, you operate it, and then presumably at the end of its life, you hand it back and they cut it up or something. That's not how it works in cyber and space. You work much more blended with your industry partners. And I think getting better and better with integrating with industry is going to be a really important part of life. And again, I think one of the lessons we're getting from Ukraine that we're being reminded of, because we know these things, we just forget them, is that armies, navies and air forces win battles, but nations win wars. And that's true with us too. So I think the degree to which that you have soldiers, sailors, aviators, civil servants working much more closely with industry is part of that national resilience that leads to you being able to win and therefore deter wars.
You can't give everything away at the same time. You've got to be fairly guarded. How do you maintain your own firewalls within our own AI system?
Interoperability, as we used to call it. We tend to talk more broadly about integration now, because integrating data is the way that you know, for instance, develop a command and control system across the alliance or across with friends and partners. That's always a challenge, and you've got to work out what data you want to share, what information you want to share, and to what degree you're going to make that vulnerable by sharing it. I mean, we work very, very closely with our closest partners. I mean, people will understand, I think it's a matter of public record, just how close the intelligence relationship with folk like the US or with Australia is. You know, you've seen AUKUS over the past couple of years, and clearly if you're sharing in this case, nuclear propulsion knowledge with each other, you know, that's pretty valuable knowledge. And we've got to work out ways of sharing that securely and sensibly. And that's been a challenge for, again, pretty much, you know, all of history.
Close to home. That hasn't worked with the recently with the Germans, has it, when they leaked information about our operations in Ukraine?
I think these sort of things will come and go. We've all had moments like that. I think, you know, we work very, very closely with our German partners, and they're hugely important and getting more and more important. So I think, you know, I don't think any of our allies or partners can stand there with 100% track record of never getting anything wrong. I think the question for us is the day after something goes wrong is, can we strengthen those partnerships, or do we let the enemy make them weaker? And certainly my vote is to make our partnership stronger, not weaker.
You're now Colonel Commonwealth of Rifles, one of the great success stories of the modern army today. From the outside, a lot of people now talk about how weak the army is, how unbalanced it is, how unequipped it is. How do you keep your riflemen enthused and engaged and staying in the army, looking forward to a career ahead of them?
Well, did I mention purpose? You know, we've got a really clear purpose in the army. We've got a really clear purpose in defence. And I think you've got to keep reminding people of that purpose and make them feel that they're connected to that purpose. And did I mention teamwork and identity? You know, we've got the fortune in the Rifles of having this large regiment with a sort of national recruiting base, but also we're connected to, you know, the communities and societies we come from. And I hope that we're doing a good job of maintaining the sort of links with tradition without that tradition becoming a drag anchor. Yeah, so it acts more of as a North Star pulling us through. And of course, we're lucky that most of that tradition is about innovation. So, you know, we've always been innovative as a regiment. So you're able to say to youngsters and oldsters today in the regiment, you know, you've got this really clear purpose, we've got this really tight team, and by the way, you're free to innovate your way through to how you deliver that purpose in any way we need, and whether that's with technology or more often, you know, just unleashing a rifleman to use his cunning and nous to find a new way of doing something, not necessarily to do with anything with technology. I think that's a really good way to keep them engaged and interested.
One of the concerns is that going back to our march culture society is that we don't reach out enough to the minority elements of our march culture society to get them to join the army and to join the armed forces in general. How do you think we address that problem?
I think there are a number of ways. I mean, last week we were launching a sort of digital skills program across defence, where we're looking at how esports can be a way of engaging society. I mean, actually engaging within defence as well. You're probably aware that our youngsters, you know, play esports more than they watch television these days. So whether we want to engage the soldiers, sailors and aviators we've got in defence, or whether we want to engage out to those who might want a career in defence, or indeed to engage their parents and explain to them what we do, you know, thinking about new channels, new ways of communicating them is really, really important.
There are, I think, 56 generals in the army today, and you're one of the 12 senior generals. What's next for General Tom Coventry Sims?
It's not done me any good in the past to try and plan that out. I've followed my star, and I've done what I think makes sense for the army and defence, and I've ended up having the most amazingly nourishing, enjoyable career, and I've been able to balance, you know, being the son, the nephew, the brother of infantrymen, with my current incarnation, you know, dabbling in cyber and AI and digital and all that, whilst also being Colonel Commonwealth of the Rifles and being able to go back and talk to my roots and feel very much at home. And I'll continue to go where the wind blows me, provided I feel that, you know, I'm connected to that purpose and that I'm working with a great team. Who cares? It's great fun.
Great stuff. Tom, thank you very much for my guest on General Talk this afternoon. Marvellous.
And my thanks once again to Lieutenant General Tom Coventry Sims for being my guest on General Talk. This and a whole host of other episodes of the programme are available to download from the Army Benevolent Fund website at armybenevolentfund.org. Do join us next month as we begin a three-part series on the nation's largest employer of apprentices, the British Army. As we sign off to mechanised infantry, the regimental quick march of the Rifles, played by the band and bugles of the Rifles, from me, Harry Bucknell, thank you for listening and farewell. editing by Michael Stigliano, this has been a GameCube production for the Army Benevolent Fund.